I'm Gary Naughan. I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. The future of U.S. and China economic power, peak oil, precious metal markets, and how to invest in the future. My guest today, Dr. Stephen Leeb. Dr. Leeb is the founder and chairman, chief investment officer of Leeb Capital Management. He is also the founder of the Lee Group, which publishes an extensive line of financial newsletters, received a lot of awards, and he is also a person who has written a lot of books, 8 books on microeconomic trends, finance, and investment, and his one book, The Coming Economic Collapse, was a New York Times bestseller, but he published it prior to the collapse. He accurately predicted the dot-com bust, $100 a barrel oil in 2004, the bull market in precious metals, the inadequacy of computers to solve major challenges, the decline in home prices, and the real estate bubble. He is the author of Red Alert, How China's Growing Prosperity Threatens the American Way of Life. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's a pleasure being here.
We have an entire hour, so we're going to focus on China, and if time allows at the end, I'm going to open it up for some additional input on America's bubbles in our economy, the ones I see that represent an economic black hole, and also the signs that the U.S. poverty explosion is hitting the young and older individuals, senior citizens, and no one seems to be writing about it or discussing it and what that means for them. And also the amazing collapse of the black and Latino household wealth, the very people who supported Barack Obama and the corporate Democrats, and they get taken advantage of. We'll talk about that, time permitting. But our main issue is China. And let's begin with a larger overview. And I'm going to bring in several different points of concern and then ask you to address the ones that you feel are important from your perspective, all right?
Sure, sure.
On the one hand, we seem to be a little schizophrenic. Over the past 10 years, we have borrowed more money from China than any other trading partner or any other economic partner, including Japan, who historically have been our number one trading partner and the second largest economy in the world. Now it's third behind China. Then we borrow $1.7 trillion to support our wars and our other economic activities, and yet both through the Bush administrations and the Obama administration, we have continued to antagonize China by posturing with alliances in Australia, New Zealand, and Vietnam and Cambodia and other countries to create something of a military defense ring around the area, as if that really mattered, because no one's going to start a war with China. No one could win a war with China. But we do this, and it costs an enormous amount of money. But also it distracts us, because those people who then start a new Cold War, the super hawks, the neocons, the people got us into Iraq to begin with, and who would love to get us into another place. They got us into Libya. They're getting us into Syria, all based upon lies. And Afghanistan, they profit when we go to war anywhere in the world. They profit through private, corporate, different contracts, because wherever you're at with military input, you have to have barracks, you have to have boots, you have to have tanks, food, and all these services. Those are the companies that are really behind this. And so now they're posturing China. Then they defy China time and again. So on the one hand, how long do you think it's going to be before China suddenly realizes you shouldn't be threatening us, because it's just stupid? That's one big issue. Secondly, China, on its side, it's gone into South America and Africa, and it's built some very strong alliances where we put AFRICOM and we put military bases in Africa. Principally, China's gone in there and worked with countries, building schools and building hospitals, and helping themselves with financial incentives to the local country by taking massive amounts of land and developing the resources that are available, including mineral resources, in Africa and in South America, and therefore has very strong alliances. And lastly, no one's talking about a probability. I didn't say a possibility, I said a probability that sooner or later you will have some neocons like Netanyahu, or his Likud radicals, who will decide it's in their best interest before Obama gets out of office, because he has promised to protect them, and Congress has signed a statement to that effect, to go ahead and hit Iran's nuclear facilities. And of course, you couldn't just hit their nuclear facilities. You've got to hit everything in Iran. You have to hit their submarines, their navy, small as it may be. You've got to hit their defense positions. You've got to hit their air force. In effect, you have to really do a major bombing on Iran. And, of course, Iran is not Iraq. It's almost three times larger. It has over a million men trained in urban warfare, and they have alliances with, like, Hezbollah. And they also have alliances. Iran has alliances with China economically, with Russia economically, with India economically, with other countries. So what would that do, possibly, to the cost of oil? Because if anyone thinks you can go in there and have a war with Iran and it's not going to influence the cost of oil, they're delusional. And so today we don't think about this. We never think about unintended consequences of any of our conflicts. We just barrel like a blind bull right into any conflict, ripping the hell out of everything in our way. And we really get off on this. You know, you have all the journalists embedded who can't wait to get there to report back to Fox News or one of these other fascistic places about how, you know, how noble they are to be on the ground, being told exactly what to write and what to, you know, and what not to. And all the while, there's a different reality. Who do you alienate? How do you change the geopolitical configuration? Does this really help Israel, or does it hurt them? Because then you're going to align a lot of people, both in the Arab world and also in some cases both Sunni and Shia, which are typically against each other. So when I look at China, I'm seeing bubbles in their economy that have been hidden. I'm seeing a rollover debt system that is unique in that when debt is due, they just roll it over for another year, so they really don't have to make it accountable. I'm seeing them not as healthy as they have seemed to be, and yet I also see them as very vital. Those are my concerns. Those are my issues. Which one of those do you want to take?
Well, I think they're very well articulated, and it's hard to know where to start. But when you were going through that, Gary, what it reminded me of almost was how the Russian U.S. Cold War played out, in which we basically were able to outspend Russia, and by virtue of that, really crippled their economy. Now, China is, you know, on the verge of forcing us to spend massive amounts of money on military, et cetera. And as you were saying, you know, certain companies, industries will get the benefit of that. But in the end, we just can't afford to do that. You know, there are very serious constraints beyond just the monetary constraints and the budgetary constraints. You know, there are resource constraints. I mean, you know, one thing we haven't heard very much of lately is any comments about rare earths. Well, rare earths are very important. I mean, and we don't have them. And what we don't hear anything about is how vital China is to our, you know, industrial survival. We import more critical metals from China. Of the critical metals that we import, and those are metals that, you know, that we need to make our automobiles, we need to make our military equipment. There's a lot of them in addition to rare earths. But of those that we import, China's by far the largest exporter. And they're of vital interest to us. And I think you are right. I mean, we are trying to extend ourselves around the globe. I have no idea what's going to happen in Iran. I hope that, you know, we can, you know, basically reach some sort of accommodation, and that they, you know, use nuclear power in a peaceful way. But, you know, the moving parts there are just unbelievable. I mean, when you talk about Iran, and the first thought that comes to your mind is, of course, Israel and the existential threat to Israel. Well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Israel has a lot of atomic bombs of their own, and the Iranians are not dumb. I don't think Israel is necessarily the target. You know, maybe down the road, maybe in 10, 15 years, but I think immediately the target would be Saudi Arabia. I mean, they're a lot closer to Saudi Arabia than they are to Israel, and to establish hegemony over that part of the world would mean that they're controlling a lot of the oil in the world. I mean, a tremendous amount of the oil in the world. And that by itself gives them, makes them almost untouchable as a power. And that's all they would need to do is establish some sort of hegemony over Saudi Arabia. And that's very possible and very likely if they have nuclear arms. So, I think that we have our work cut out for us. And I think that we're, you know, I'll tell you what really gets to me is where we're really dropping the ball and where I think China is really succeeding. And it's, this doesn't, you know, really resonate right now because we've had this setback in commodities recently, and we've had this talk, as you rightfully point out, about, you know, there being a bubble in China, and I can't deny that there are certain areas of the economy that have gotten ahead of themselves, maybe dramatically so. But, you know, overall, China, I think, is fine. I mean, you know, 7% growth, 6% growth, 8% growth, whatever the number is, it so far exceeds, you know, anything that we could dream about here that it becomes a little silly to talk about, you know, an implosion in China. What China is doing, and I think doing very, very correctly, is building out a smart grid. A smart grid is an electrical system that allows you to use virtually any energy source available and use them efficiently. And this means from wind to solar to hydro to coal to, you know, to all the non-renewables, renewables. They can all be used together and effectively. And China is devoting a tremendous amount of their resources doing that. And you hear very little mention of it. That, I think, is really critical. By contrast, what we're doing is we're betting the ship, we're betting the house, the farm, if you will, on something called fracking. I don't believe that's going to work. I mean, I think it's working now, and I think it may continue to work for another year or two. But when you look at the depletion rates and the risks to our water supply, and I'm not talking about pollution or, you know, this movie that came out, I can't remember the name of it, you know, where fire starts in the water. No, I mean, you know, these are, you know, one-off examples. I'm just talking about the scarcity of water. And, you know, the fact that the two most important, that water basically is necessary and is the most necessary for both energy production and food. So, you know, devoting so much water to energy is basically, you know, taking something off our tables, ultimately. China, I think, understands this. I mean, when you talk about wind and you talk about solar, and, you know, an energy mix has to consist of a lot more than just those two, but those two don't require any water at all. And, you know, in contrast to fracking, so I'm concerned. I am very concerned. And I think that when you look at China and you look at their, you know, posture vis-a-vis the rest of the world, you realize that their alliances are always self-serving. You mentioned, I think, Africa. You mentioned South America. Well, these are self-serving alliances in that what China is desperate for, or not, well, maybe desperate's too strong a word, maybe not, but what China seeks are resources, and they do what they need to get resources. And the only military actions that you see from China are those that are over resources, like the South China Sea with Japan. I don't think that's going to amount to a whole lot of anything. I think they'll end up splitting the difference, if you will. But China is not And I don't think historically, and I know a little bit about history, and they say a little knowledge can be dangerous, so, you know, if I make a wrong statement, correct me. But, you know, two things about China. I mean, they've been the world's leading economic power in 16 out of the last 18 centuries. The last two were the two that they were not, and I don't think they want to make it three in a row. But also, during that period of time, I think one reason China has been, historically, has been as successful as they've been, is that they're very inward-looking. I mean, what they do is for the sake of China. They're not trying to spread Confucianism across the globe. They're not trying to spread Buddhism across the globe. They're not trying to spread their way of life across the globe. They are very Chinese-centric, and by and large, the Communist Party in China is a party of the people. Now, admittedly, it's authoritarian. There's a mass amount of corruption. There are, you know, there's a laundry list a mile long of what's wrong. But in the end, China is doing a lot more right today than I think we are, and I think that's what we have to wake up to. And if we, you know, get into some sort of a military buildup, because of China, they won't follow. I mean, why do they have to follow? I mean, they've already got nuclear weapons. They already have an army that you know, potentially exceeds us. I mean, remember the one-child policy and all the young men that have been born? I mean, that's a tremendous source to draw from, et cetera, et cetera. So that I hope, coming back to what I said originally, that someone minding the shop in this country has a sense to realize that, you know, we're not going to get anywhere by, you know, rapidly building up our military. Again, it's almost like the Cold War in reverse. We're on the wrong side of this one. China may be on the right side if we play into it. So I think we've got to forget about any of these military and battering our chest, et cetera. And I still don't think it's too late for America to do things right. But, brother, okay. I mean, I keep saying that the time is short, and it's extremely short. And I'll just leave by saying, you know, one thing, this, you know, recent downturn in commodities, you know, sort of it's made us even more complacent. But commodity scarcity, Gary, it is with us. It is one of the major themes,
Stephen,
and it's going to be a theme for the next decade, 20 years, 30 years or more.
I'm going to get to that in a few moments. Now, I'm going to ask you, if you would, please, a little shorter answers, because I've got a lot of issues I want to cover.
I'm sorry about that.
No, that's fine. We got the big issue, the overview, out of the way. Now let's go to specifics. Because recently there's been signs of cracks in China's economy and serious questions whether predictions that China's economy will surpass the U.S., as most analysts believe earlier, will come to fruition. China now holds $23 trillion in total credit, about equal to the U.S.'s in banking system. But their export market, which has been critical for its growth strategy, is now shrinking a bit, and they're using more of their own product internally, and their average wages for their own workers is up, and they're having a more vital working middle class than the United States. In April, Fitch Rating downgraded China's long-term currency debt due to the overexpansion of credit. On the other hand, if we believe that the United States will remain top economic dog, there is the fact that China holds $1.6 trillion in treasury bills. China is challenging the dollar as the world's reserve currency by flooding the world with their currency, and we remain uncertain about the true health of the U.S. economy. Yet U.S. and China seem to coexist in a kind of codependent marriage, each needing and relying upon the health of the other in order to continue their respective economic growth. So speak about the China-U.S. codependent relationship and why entering a kind of economic war against China, like the one isolationist members of Congress proposed, would not bear well for either country.
I think any sort of war in a world that's as interconnected as our world is not going to be a very good war. I think it's, you know, a much better idea, though, instead of thinking of confronting China, is thinking of beating China at their own game and saying to ourselves, how can we assure an energy infrastructure that's going to provide a good standard of living for this century, for the 21st century. I think we have to think in terms of longer time bites and less in terms of immediate confrontations, because China won't play that game. They'll do whatever they have to do to avoid real confrontations with the U.S. because they'll let us spend ourselves silly, and we'll have much less money to get those vital resources. And China right now is, you're right, you said one thing, that China is focusing inward. They are. And you know, anyone that thinks China doesn't have the wherewithal to grow should basically look at their individual savings rate. It's about 50%. If that falls to 30%, think of the kind of growth they're going to have. And as you pointed out, wages are rising. And they basically have transitioned a lot of their economy from export-oriented to consumption-oriented. And I think that transition will continue.
To add a point to what you just said, of the 27 leading nations in the developed part of the world, the United States is dead last in the average middle income net earnings or wealth. Now, Australia was number one with $200,000, and New Zealand was right behind it. But even Spain and Greece, the average person there, the average middle-class person, actually has more net value than the $36,000 for the average American. And China doesn't have figures on what their net earners are, but right now they're passing India with 400 million. That's 400 million individuals who are considered highly educated or well-educated and able to support their economy, so they have the demands for televisions and cars and clothes and things that they once would have had savings for. They didn't have those. Now they do, and still they have one of the highest savings rate, if not the highest saving rate in the world. That said, what are your views about China at some point deciding to dump the Treasury bill, and what would that do to our standing in the world? And then second, what would happen to the prices of gold if the dollar loses its current position, and would that affect the value of property and hard assets and inflation and silver?
Well, I think that, you know, the last question is really the critical question, and I think that this is really one of China's end games, is to establish the yuan as a more important currency in the world than the dollar. And I don't think they have to have a long way to travel in order to do that. Whereas in recent days, the credit squeeze, the sharply rising short-term rates, spiking rates in China were making a lot of headlines, there was another story, and that was an agreement that China signed with Britain, a swap agreement, so that yuan, the Chinese currency, can be readily exchanged for the pound and other currencies. And, you know, London and Britain have made no qualms about it. They want to be the center of that of the yuan exchange. And also, in recent days, China has launched a gold ETF. And the Shanghai Exchange continues to grow and grow very, very rapidly. And I think basically, Gary, and this has been my abiding view for some time, is China's goal is to amass a massive amount of gold. I think they're doing it. What we see reported, I think, is not nearly the whole story. I think a lot of gold comes in through ports that we may not even know about. But it is true that China is amassing, you know, incredible amount, tremendous amounts of gold. And at a certain point, they're going to say, okay, here's the yuan. People are trading it all around the globe. We've made our financial system more transparent, which I think is part of what you're seeing right now. I mean, there's a little short-term pain, but the long-term gain is a more transparent financial system. And we're going to partially back our yuan with gold. Now, you know, I think the yuan then becomes a much more attractive currency than the dollar. And what happens to gold? Well, just think about it. If oil and other metals are priced as as a percent of an ounce of gold, gold could take off, go up many fold, which is really what I expect to see happen over the next 5, 6, 7 years. I think gold could, multiply many times in value as its role as a reserve currency becomes more and more fixed. I don't think that gold will ever be, the single reserve currency, but I think gold, the yuan, maybe a few other currencies, maybe they'll have a place for the dollar, but not very big, will also play a role. But I think this is the end game. And, for us, it could be just horrendous. One reason we can print so much currency now, even though we owe everybody and their uncle massive amounts of dollar, including the Chinese, as you alluded to, but one reason we get away with that is because we are the reserve currency. But you take that away from us, and you're going to have inflation in this country like you've never seen before, including the Civil War. Who knows where it'll go, but it will go very, very, very high. So I would say grab your gold now while it's cheap. Grab your silver now while it's cheap. I think hard assets are really the long-term place to be. There's no doubt about it in my mind.
Tell me if you think that this is in or out of a sense of reality. I'm suggesting to people that when the dollar loses the position of the exclusive reserve currency, and the yuan and mixed currencies, I believe there'll be mixed currencies along with gold, take their position, I believe that the dollar will drop at least 15% in value. But also I believe we're going to get hit with hyperinflation, unlike anything we've seen, including during the 1970s under Carter. And I also believe that at the same time we're going to have a form, a genetically modified form of hyper deflation, and that's not a contradiction to having hyperinflation deflation. It's just I believe we're going to have a reduced value in what we buy, but an increased cost to buy it. So we buy something at a higher price because of the inflationary factor, but then the value of that, measured against the standards we will not have the same value. So I'm telling people now, I believe gold could easily go from $5,000 to $7,000 an ounce, and I believe at that time, and I believe that silver could easily go to $200 an ounce at that time and thereafter. And I'm looking at China. China, we know on the books they're telling us they're making 960 tons, metric tons of gold per year, and then they're buying additional metric tons, hundreds on top of that. So there's no one in the world right now that's involved in gold year in and year out as much as they are. Also, they control 90% of the world's precious minerals. We don't care about that. They do. We don't care about copper. They care about copper. And they care about other minerals that are needed in manufacturing, including the very things that make our life supposedly more convenient, including cell phones and computers and the technological apparatus. Well, if you control 90% of the rapid depleting natural resources, then that puts you in a rather unique position in the world, and it makes other people more susceptible to tipping. So then I'm saying, all right, then what do we do? Well, then if you look at metals such as indium and tantalum and vanadium and graphite, and other rare minerals, they're up to their eyeballs in that because for over two decades they've been making deals with people in different countries, and there's sometimes they're not doing it always in their name. They're doing it frequently in partnership with local governments and other corporations, but they're the dominant person on the block, and no one's talking about this. Your thoughts on what I just said, is this in the realm of reasonableness or not?
No, it's, you're taking, I could, quote you. I basically agree with what you're saying. I think China gets it. And, one reason they get it is that they think longer term than we do. And as a result, they, they do accumulate these metals. I think Deng said back in the 80s, that, the Middle East has their oil, but we have our rare earths. Now, whoever would have thought that rare earths would become so valuable? And yet here we are in, you know, the second decade of the 21st century, I don't know, 30, 40 years past when Deng made that comment. And all of a sudden, rare earths, especially those heavy rare earths that are critical for anything magnetic, have become exceedingly valuable and critical. And, you know, this is just part of China's long-term thinking. And they, you know, they're just very much more willing to look over a temporary valley if they see, you know, green ahead. And, you know, that's what you're seeing right now. I mean, they're making their whole monetary system, in my opinion, much, much more transparent. And we'll know what's on their books. And if there's too much of this or too much of that, it'll show up and it'll be written off. And I have, you know, no doubt at the end of the day that, you know, Chinese banks will look a lot healthier than U.S. banks. And, you know, certainly comparing China now to the U.S. in 2008, I mean, it just makes no sense at all. I mean, you know, their banks have $3 trillion on deposit with their central bank, and they have sitting with $3.3 trillion in reserves, including, as you mentioned, all those treasuries. I mean, this is not a country that's in any kind of long-term trouble. It's not a country that's ready to implode. It's a country that is recognizing that, you know, along with a lot of growth came, you know, some corruption, came some projects that should not have been built. And, you know, there have been a few bubbles here and there. And they're cleaning the decks right now. I mean, you know, Xi is a very, very bright guy. Li is a very, very bright guy. I mean, these guys didn't rise to power because they greased hands or you know, found some sort of loophole in the system. They came to power because they're very, very skilled. And, you know, all the trouble, it seems like they're getting rid of it now. I mean, they're sort of creating a transparent China. And, brother, the dangers to us in that are so great. Because, you know, it again leads the way to the Chinese currency becoming a much more important reserve currency than the dollar. And as you said, when that happens, our standards of living in every way decline, in every way decline. And, you know, I don't want that to happen. No, I really don't
want it to happen. I'm doing a model homestead now with hydroponics to show people that they should be growing things that we will have to eat and can profit from it, but also are sustainable and green and authentic. And
right, and, yes, and, there are things we can do, and the government should be encouraging you, Gary.
But it's not. It's actually fighting us. The government's actually against because of its selection of the USDA head and the FDA top safety advisor from Monsanto, both. We end up getting slammed, and the small. I'm a certified organic farmer. I've been teaching organic farming. I've led who knows how many tens of millions of people are now eating organic because I've been talking about it for the last 35 years.
Good for you.
And on my ABC shows for 12 years, WOR for years, WEBD for over 12 years, and now on the Progressive Radio Network and Pacifica for 36 years. So we're getting the word out. But at the same time, the government is saying, no, GMO only. And that's stupid. Now, that leads me, Steve, into this issue. And it's actually interconnected issues. On the one hand, China, I believe, did more harm in a short period of time to its environment than any other society in the world during that same period of time. 26,000 rivers are no longer actual rivers in China because of damming and because of pollution. They also have the highest rate of desertification in the world. They're losing over 5,000 acres per day to desertification. And over 26,000 towns, hamlets, and small cities are now being overtaken by the desert. So what did they do? They shift gears. Now they have 5,500 miles of high-speed trains, including some of the levitation magnetic trains that can go 260 miles an hour, and they're looking at a 300-mile-an-hour model now. We have zero in the United States, by the way. They are looking at their infrastructure, and reclaiming it. They're doing more with solar than any other country in the world, including Germany. They're making it more affordable in smaller units. And so I see them making a turn here. Now, that said, and I want you to address that, also, I see an enormous difference between what the model China is using and what America is using. Well, China has been involved with some volatile bubbles, as you are aware. But in the United States, we have a credit card bubble, a student loan bubble. We are reinflating the subprime bubble. We have a commercial real estate bubble, a hedge fund bubble, an equity partnership bubble, and a derivatives bubble. Which of these do you find most likely to cause problems? And when you look at China, when we were going through our 2007-08 crisis and the burst of the mortgage and derivative bubble, China doesn't play the same type of casino gambling card that we do, and hence was relatively unscathed from the crisis. So what does this tell us about the current system in the United States that is leading to these bubbles?
Well, I mean, it tells you that, look, yeah. I'm blocking his name out. Timothy Geithner was head of the New York Fed during the bubble that occurred in 2008. So instead of getting some sort of comeuppance, and this is just one example, he became Treasury Secretary. And everybody that was around in 2008 is still around today. So it sort of tells you that, you know, the kind of government that we have right now is not one that, you know, doles out rewards and punishments based upon past performance. And that's a very dangerous thing. You know, one comment, and I may have mentioned this when I was talking to you before, Gary, it really struck home. Jeremy Grantham, he's a man in his 70s. He's an extraordinarily capable money manager. I think he manages hundreds of billions of dollars. And has become a real hawk on the environment and a real hawk on resource scarcity. And he recently, when I say recently, within the last 6 to 9 months, he penned an opinion piece in Nature magazine, which is one of the top science magazines in the world. And it's really the only money manager I've ever seen pen a piece there. But one comment that he made was chilling. He said that big oil is going to, you know, drill and drill and drill till basically there's no more oil left in the ground. He said, and then went on to say, you know, big oil basically controls Congress. They have their way with Congress. And I said, my gosh, that's not democracy as we know it. I mean, you know, that's a plutocracy. I mean, that's where, you know, the wealthy are ruling things, and they're ruling it for their own gain. And, you know, I'm not saying similar things don't happen in China, but, you know, writ much, much smaller. And, you know, that's really, really horrifying if you think about it. I mean, fracking is just some sort of wide-eyed gamble on something that is very, very unlikely to succeed, except succeed for the few people that will benefit financially, which are, of course, the oil companies and the oil service companies. So I think that, you know, the lesson from China, they have a problem. Their problem is burning too much coal. Their problem, as you said, you know, massive pollution. Let's correct that. And now all of a sudden, this country, which basically didn't have really much of a stake in alternative or renewable energies at all 10 years ago, really control the wind market in the world and control the solar market in the world. How did that happen?
And they're now going towards wave power and seaweeds.
Totally, yes. And they're also going toward desalinization in a very, very big way. And they're going to spread their, you know, the stuff and use it to export. And, yeah, they are. They're using everything at their disposal because I really believe that, you know, look, you know, accepting a lot of corruption, I'm not naive about this, but on balance, I believe that the leaders of the Chinese party really believe they're there to serve the Chinese people. And, you know, I've read books and books about this. It doesn't mean that you don't get a bad apple every once in a while. Of course you do. Bo, he was a bad apple. And it doesn't mean that you don't do terrible things every once in a while. And, you know, they're a more primitive society than we are in many ways. But at the same time, I do believe that their leaders, Xi and Lee, at this point, are doing everything they can that's in the interest of perpetuating China as a power throughout this century. And we just are not there. We're not acting in a similar fashion. And I really rue that. I really regret it. And I just hope somebody can wake us up and remind us of who we really are and how we got there.
Stephen, we know who we are and we know how we got there. The trouble is the people who know who they are the sociopaths who run our economies and run our major corporations and the Council on Foreign Relations and who have their own their agenda of what the world should be like, and their policymakers, and the think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, and the Free Enterprise Institute, and the Cato Institute. They have their own ideas, not illegal, but I consider extremely narrow, about how the world should be, and therefore they have the policymakers. ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, has 300 members, more or less, for 35 years, working secretly behind the scenes, writing bills that become laws at the state level, and having relationships that benefit the state lawmaker, but not the citizens. So they know who they are. No one wakes up in America in the corporate suit and doesn't recognize the face in the mirror. They don't see themselves as immoral. They don't see themselves as amoral. They don't see themselves even as George Soros, who I can't stand because of his arrogance on when he said that, you know, how he makes his money is really not the issue. And he, you know, yeah, well, you shorted the currency in Russia, you caused 100 million Russians to suffer and starve, and you did the same thing in South America. And he's a darling of the left. So as long as he, like Tinkerbell, as long as he sprinkles magic dust around a liberal and some famous women's radio shows and their foundations, everybody kisses him. Now, well, you know, and he holds out his ring and says, I'll throw a million your way and your way. And I'm repulsed by this notion of what happens on the corporate right, much as I'm repulsed by the corporate left, as I'm repulsed by the corporate right and the control they have over our body politic. The confusion is that we can't change because we're addicted to the consequences and the benefits of power. And small groups of people have figured out how to work collectively or cooperatively with one another to maintain this. The Chinese, on the other hand, who've made monstrous decisions, the invasion of Tibet, the harvesting of human organs from the Falun Gong, the barbarity of their human rights violations, which are still going on, they at least have one thing that you mentioned that separates them. When they see that there's a crisis and they have the right leadership, they have the power to collectively shift gears and get into the solution much faster than any other country in the world. And so now they are leading in the areas that will be the future. We're not. We're still stuck in the idea, and you mentioned the gas hydrofracking. Water is important. You mentioned it takes 2 million gallons per well. But it's not the gas companies or the oil companies making the money from fracking. It's the syndicates. If anyone took the time to look, it's one of the biggest bubbles out there. The people who get people into the syndicates, and they give you this song and dance. Well, we're going to go in and buy this lease for $5,000. And we're going to give the person one-third of 1% of royalty, which is nothing. And we've got clearance from the local community. And we're going to frack the heck out of that, and we're going to extract that, and we're going to ship it out. And no one's actually saying, what is the cost-profit ratio? Because if they did, nobody would put a nickel into fracking. It's all a pyramid scheme. I'm telling you now, Stephen, the entire fracking industry is one big pyramid scheme. And the investors at the syndicate level are the ones making out like bandits because they could have 5 or 10,000 people into a syndicate, each giving, let's say, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, each thinking they're going to be, you know, making a lot of money. It's as stupid as owning a racehorse. And I didn't think anybody could be as dumb as people who own a racehorse.
You've said so many things that, you know, resonate so well with me. I mean, you know, the one thing I just have to say, you're abhorrent of both the right and the left. I mean, I could not agree more. I mean, I think we have to recognize that we're Americans, and that foremost, and that, you know, we're all on the same side here, guys. Come on, let's stop this extremism and this bickering and this fighting. I mean, I really agree with you on that. I also agree with you on the atrocities that have come out of China and the disregard of human life that they've displayed. I mean, it's horrible. It's really, really just terrible. I can't defend it, and I'm not trying to defend it, but they do come together as a people when they need to come together. And, you know, right now I think that that's exactly what you're seeing. And, you know, as far as fracking, I could not agree more. I did not know about the syndicates and don't understand that. I have to do a little bit more work on that, admittedly, but I do know that anything that has a depletion rate, 60, 80, 90% a year, I mean, you know, you're running just to stay in place. And it's just a catastrophe. It really is. And I really think China understands this a lot better than we do. So much better. I mean, we can't understand it because it's every man for himself in this country. And, you know, it's not just every man for himself. I mean, what you said, and I think it's a very, it's very well put. I mean, we're obsessed with power. And it's power in the end that really, you know, drives us. I don't see that in the Chinese. I mean, I don't see that from what little I've studied about Chinese history, Confucianism, etc. That's more about respect. That's more about seeing, you know, a global view of things rather than just focusing on the center and saying, I want that. You know, that sort of focus on the center and wanting it, that can be very useful at certain times, but not in today's world when everything is so interdependent, when resources are becoming scarcer, when, you know, you have to know when to ignore and when to pay attention to particular cycles, etc. I mean, China has this kind of global. It's ironic because as insular as they are and as unwilling as they are to try and spread their philosophy, they're very global in terms of their perspective on things and much more so than we. You know, we see, you know, an opportunity in Iraq. What do? We go in there without analyzing what the costs were. I mean, even if we went in there for oil, how much sense did that make? It's the Chinese that are getting the oil out of Iraq because they're the ones that are willing to put a paramilitary into Iraq. The ditto with Afghanistan. We're in Afghanistan fighting a war, and the Chinese are there mining copper with another paramilitary. It's loony what we're doing. Let's wake up, America. Let's stop this right and left, and let's, you know, yes, it's okay to have political parties. I'm all for it. I'm totally for democracy. But we have gotten so far away from what any of our founding fathers meant by democracy. I mean, you know, the little person you mentioned at the top of your show. You know, the Latino, the poor people in this country, they don't have a vote. You can't tell me that their vote is as important as George Soros's. I mean, that's ridiculous. They don't have a vote at all, and they don't have a say in what happens to them. And, you know, that really is dangerous. It is so dangerous to social cohesion in this country. It really is. And, you know, things could easily go wrong here that could, you know, really threaten the very fabric of this society. I don't want to get carried away or scare people, but, you know, come on, America, let's get together. Let's find some common ground. And, you know, that common ground could be building out a new energy system. Throw out the energy companies, the oil companies. They have enough. Let's do something a little bit more worthwhile.
I would agree with that, Stephen. Let's go to this area. It's a fascinating concept. I'm going to throw out a hypothetical with variables. We know that Fukushima was understated in its severity. The Japanese government intentionally and with malice aforethought lied to their own public. They then had all forms of scams. For example, they would go into an area near Fukushima And when they saw that the people were exposed to a very high and unsafe level of radiation, they simply raised the level that a person can be exposed to, so they didn't have to have a massive evacuation further out than about 26 miles, as if somehow some law of physics stops radiation at a certain mileage. They also would clean up an area, dig down 3 feet, then they would put a meter there, say, oh, see, it's not too bad here, but if you went 3 feet away, it would. There's 1,200 hot spots of radiation independently confirmed by activist scientists in Japan. I brought over the leading, the Ralph Nader of Japan, a woman who is leading the charge to tell the public of Japan the truth. Now, here's the deal. We've studied this very carefully. Professor Carl Grossman, Professor Wasserman and Vandana Shiva, Michio Kaku, Helen Collicott. We're talking about the leading people who have a scientific background to understand the truth. And we all come to this insight that because Fukushima is still active as it was on day one, and we've forgotten it because it's not our news cycle, it's only a matter of time before the spent fuel rods collapse in that one building, making it 60 times worse than Chernobyl. And that means that there won't be any safe place in Japan to live. The food will be polluted. The water is polluted. The aquifer is now polluted in many areas. And so what do you do with a population, including the largest population for a city in the world, Tokyo, over 40 million? It's only about 160 miles away. Now, at the same time, you have China. And China built, during a 12-year period, 67 phantom cities that holds about, and some are very large, that hold up about 60 million people. No one lives there in their interior. They're also doing the same thing in Africa. Also, they have some islands that have been in contention that could be used for resettlement. Do you see at some point, due to the highly caustic situation of radioactivity making life less than healthy in Japan, that there may be an effort for the Japanese and Chinese to cooperate together in some lease or some other arrangement to move some of their manufacturing or their citizens into Chinese property?
I do. I mean, you know, frankly, I think that that is possible. I think that if any two countries can overcome the historical animosity that obviously exists between China and Japan, those are two countries that can. I mean, my goodness, you know, Germany and the U.S. today are allies. The U.S. and Japan are allies today. So, I mean, to me, if it's in China's interest to form a strong alliance with Japan, I think they will. And I think that there's no doubt. I mean, what you're describing, and I really don't know enough to comment about, you know, how far that radiation is spread, et cetera. But, you know, to the extent that it makes sense for the Japanese and the Chinese to come together and form a very strong alliance, of course, I don't see any reason why not. You know, providing, you know, they have the protections in, et cetera. And in today's world, I think that's very easy to do. So, you know, they're trading partners. They're already allies, Gary, if you want to know the truth. I mean, the truth is that they're I think, probably each is the other's most important trading partner. Don't quote me on that, but they're certainly very important to each other in terms of trade. And what you're talking about is really just an extension of trade. And I think, you know, it's very easy to see that happening, that that they, you know, form much, much stronger ties than they have right now. Sure, I think that's very easy to see.
I agree. I just see I'm on top of the Fukushima and the radiation issue, and boy, have we missed this story, and it's an important one.
You could be totally right. And obviously, if we've missed it, I've missed it too. And, you know, one of the things I'm going to do when this interview was over, one of the first things I'm going to do is try and find out a lot more about that. Because, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, radiation is a very, very tough thing to deal with. I mean, there's no way of dealing with it. basically. I mean, you know, we don't have like pills that you can take that, you know, make you invulnerable. No, it can be extraordinarily serious.
And there's the lesson of the lies of the Russian government when it denied to the world how severe Chernobyl was.
Oh, it's horrible, yes.
And there are 5,000 scientific journals that have published articles in Slavic that show that 1 million Russians and Ukrainians died because of the fallout of Chernobyl, even those that were 200 miles away, because contaminated dairy and food. So I think that as long as China has massive room and resources in place, that we may see something there. I just think it will take maybe a year or two for that to develop, because China, I believe, is closing in on becoming the world's number one economy.
Well, I think they are. And, you know, one thing I just have to add to your thinking, and it's the only thing I can add to your thinking, is that what China gets in return is a lot of technology from Japan. I mean, Japan is, a leading technological power, and I don't think they've ever lost that edge. And I think China is hungry for as many technologies as they can get. I think that's the one spot that China lacks. So there could be, you know, lots of reasons to suppose you're absolutely right. It would make sense for both governments, for both countries, to join and to have a very strong alliance. I can definitely see it happening. I mean, again, I just keep coming back to U.S. and Japan, U.S. and Germany. I mean, you know, really, I mean, you know, these were the most bitter enemies of ours, and now they're among our strongest allies. So can China and Japan get together? Of course, absolutely.
Stephen, we're out of time. Thank you very much for coming on and sharing some very valued insights with us today.
I just have to thank you for sharing your insights with me, and just want to, you know, say this is one of the fastest hours I've ever spent in my life.
All the best to you. And the book is Red Alert, How China's Growing Prosperity Threatens the American Way of Life. The website is Lieb, LEEB.com, and or LEEB.net. All the best to you, Stephen.
Thank you so much, Gary. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that's Dr. Stephen Lieb, the founder and chairman and chief investment officer for Lieb Capital Management. And he's done so much good work, and you heard him. He's very much of the belief that I am, that I believe that the depressed price of silver at $19 and gold, and who knows how low that could go. That could go 800. But I believe that's only temporary. And the moment our economy is hit with the dollar no longer being the reserve and all forms of things change, then watch what happens. Thank you very much for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program.